Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
No, we're off. Okay, here we are. Oh, my God. Oh, what a day. What a week. What a month. What a year. What a decade. Crash bang. What a video. It's so good to see you, Nat. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, you know. It's nice to see you. I feel like it's been a long time, but it's only been a week, isn't it?
It's been a week and a day. We couldn't record on our normal Wednesday slot. And, but that last episode feels like it was a month ago.
Yeah, it feels ages ago.
But it wasn't, as you say. It was a week and a day. Yeah, good. Right.
You're coming to us live from your kitchen, which is unusual. We don't normally see your kitchen. It's a very lovely kitchen.
I had a gig last night. Well, also, I sit very low in my chair normally. So I had a gig last night and I decided that I was going to move into my kitchen so that I could sit at my counter, my kitchen counter, and sit more upright.
Posture.
Yeah, for my posture maybe. And I actually think that there's better light here and I quite like it. So obviously not on Zoom, it looks terrible, but in terms of I can see the sky. What a beautiful day it is today, guys.
It is out of nowhere. What was your thing yesterday? Was that your gig? Or is that why you couldn't record yesterday? Were you practising or doing some prep?
No, I had about 10 minutes to prep my gig yesterday. It's like one of those things. I don't know if you're the same, Nat, but what I will do is I will book a gig in and then I'll think, yes, I will prep that. And then it will be the day of the gig and I'll be like, I didn't prep it.
Yeah. And then in the interim, do you feel sick about it, though?
Yeah.
I feel that kind of thing, like, oh, I've got that to do next week. I've got that to do tomorrow.
If I book a gig, well, like we, this is sort of terrible. Like, when I'm on stage, I like it. Everything, every single moment that it takes for me to get on stage is terrible. So just when COVID started, I think I was due, the week we went into lockdown, I think I was due to go on tour the next week maybe. And I was so stressed about it. And it was, and when COVID happened, it was sort of like a snow day where they said, oh, the tour's been moved. And I was like, oh, okay, well, where's it been moved to? It got moved to September. And then it got moved again to the beginning, to next spring. And even though it was moved like basically a year from when I was meant to do it, it's still been hanging over me that in a year's time, I had to do like a 30-day tour or a 20-day tour, like finish off my tour. And now it's kind of like a few months away. We don't know whether we've got to move it again or cancel it altogether or what. We don't know, right? It's just been hanging over me the whole time and it makes me feel sick. And I almost like paralyzed to the point where it's like, I almost have to trick myself. I know that I'll be all right when I get going, but to get to that point. So like yesterday I was filming, it was such a long day. I went to bed at a reasonable time. But I got about 20 minutes sleep. You do this thing where you think that I did some filming last week as well. I've done sort of like a filming thing every week for the last few weeks. One day a week for the last few weeks. So that's good. You did it. And so last week I was going to bed. I had to get up at 5:30. And I set my alarm. But I set my alarm for 5:30 p.m. And I just caught myself just before I went to sleep. I was just like, no, God, don't do that. Fucking hell. Oh, God, I almost fucked up. And so then I set it for 5:30 a.m. But like, you always just panic that you're going to oversleep and you're going to miss the thing. And that's never, it only happened once, but where I overslept Well, I told you about the time when I was directing a school play.
No, I don't think so.
I must have. But, you're listening to Fan Club. My name's Nick. This is
Daniel Metcalf.
First rule of Fan Club is...
Tell your friends.
Second rule of Fan Club is...
Please, please, for the love of God, tell your friends.
About Fan Club. Do you know what? We've been saying that so long that I actually forgot that it was a reference to Fight Club. I was trying to remember what the second rule of Fan Club, of Fight Club was. I was talking about the 1999 was the best year. Was it the second best year in cinema? The best year in cinema was like 1982. And then the next best year in cinema was 1999. And that's the year, like, loads of stuff, like The Matrix, Fight Club. I mean, they're not necessarily my favourite films, but, like, there was just a banger that came out every 2 weeks. You know, like Rushmore, American Beauty. Obviously, End of Days. You know, just getting there, just getting right in there right at the end. And I was remembering that, and then I was, like, going, first rule of Fight Club is... don't talk about Fight Club. I couldn't remember what the second rule was, so I was like, oh yeah, it's that. Anyway, so I was working on an independent film, and my alarm didn't go off, and I missed my call time by like an hour.
This for your school play?
No, this isn't a school play. This is an independent film. And I missed the call, but because it was so low budget and independent, they were way behind schedule. And actually, it was all right. But, it was terrible. But that's the only time it's ever happened. And it's the worst. It's the absolute worst. It's like, so whenever I've got filming, I don't sleep. And I think if it's the first day of a job, like if you're about to do like 7 weeks on Uncle, you don't sleep for the first day and then you can sleep after that. But if you're only doing one day on something, it's the same thing. You don't sleep, and then you're only doing one day. And so it's been like for every single project that I've done in the last few weeks, you just don't sleep. And that's what happened.
So a series of Uncle would take to film 7 weeks?
Yeah, there's basically... you can basically film about 5 minutes a day. And then there's like a rollover week to pick up anything that you've missed. But actually, the last series we did 7 episodes, so I think it might have been an 8 week shoot. Loaded was 5.5 months.
Wow!
With two weeks rehearsals, so it was 6 months, and that's a fucking less than COVID, but less than lockdown. But I mean, it was like 6 months. It's like, you know, I don't know. It's kind of, if you thought about it at the beginning, you'd go mental. Like the same schedule every day, getting up at 5:30 and then finish at whatever, 7 o'clock at night. You get home at 9 and then you just do it every day for 6 months. It's kind of like, it's actually really fun and you get used to it. And actually the mornings aren't that bad because your alarm goes off at 5:30. If it's a Saturday and you wake up at 10 and you lie in bed for like an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. It's hard to get out of bed sometimes. But if you're getting up at 5:30 in the morning, you sort of like leap out of bed and just like, right, I'm doing it. Okay, let's do it. There's no point in waking up at 5:30 if you're just going to lie in bed for like. So you can do it. So you always write. But yesterday was another sort of like, it was quite a long day, and I was filming for a thing. And then I got in. I think the gig was at 8, and I was filming in Battersea until 6:30, and so I literally got in at 7. I was so tired. I just sort of like sat very still in the car, and then I got in, and then it was chaos. And then I managed to put an hour and 20 minutes of stuff together. And I was like, I kept talking until I sort of
You put an hour and 20 minutes together in faster than real time.
Yeah, I did. I put an hour and 20 minutes together. I put an hour and 20 minutes together in 15 minutes. And it was good.
Michael J. Fox filming
Back to the Future.
Back to the Future at the same time.
Yes, Family Ties, Back to the Future. So he would film Family Ties, and Family Ties wouldn't let him out of his contract. That's a really lovely story, is that he was filming Teen Wolf, and on the other side of town, they were filming Back to the Future with Eric Stoltz. It's actually, it depends if you're Team Michael or Team Eric. I really love Eric Stoltz. I think it's what a weird career. Mm. So, do you know what I mean? It's like he had like a parallel career where he was making teen comedies at the same time as Michael J. Fox. And then by the time he did, like, he was Lance in Pulp Fiction. And he was in Killing Zoe as well, which was produced by Tarantino. So he had sort of like this weird sort of like parallel career where they were both Michael J. Fox, they were both Marty McFly at one point. And then, so basically, the people that made Back to the Future, they wanted Michael J. Fox. Michael J. Fox wasn't allowed out of his Family Ties contract. So they ended up having to recast him with Eric Stoltz. Eric Stoltz filmed for, what, 6 weeks?
Something like that. And they just said it didn't quite work, or it wasn't.
He's a very serious actor. He's sort of like a method actor. And he played it like a haunted and harrowed teenager. And there wasn't sort of like a lightness. You know, you're always talking about light comedy, what a skill light comedy is.
I think Michael J. Fox is a perfect example of that as well. Just how... It's invisible as well in general. It's that thing where it's doing something, being kind of funny without being comedic. It's just that kind of... It's like a lightness of touch or something.
Yeah.
Hugh Grant's very good at it. That's why I often talk about him as well. He's kind of yeah, very well.
There's something going on behind their eyes that isn't intensity, you know? It's kind of like, and Cary Grant as well, I think it's a real sort of like underrated skill. Anyway, so Eric Stoltz, they had to fire Eric Stoltz. All of the cast were sort of like, except for Thomas Wilson, who didn't get on with it. I think all of the cast were sort of, and then I think they had to recast Jennifer because the original actress that played Jennifer was way too tall for Michael J. Fox. But everyone had like worked with Eric Stoltz for like all this time, and then Michael J. Fox had to come in. So they wouldn't let him out of his contract for Family Ties. So what he would do is he would film Family Ties from like, I guess he was getting, well, I mean, he would be filming it and rehearsing it all week. And then from like 9 o'clock in the morning to whatever at night. And then he would get in a car, and they would drive him across town, and he'd sleep in the car for like an hour, and then he would film Back to the Future all night, which is why I guess all the parking lot stuff, aside from plot, the parking lot stuff is all at night. So it was actually quite kind of like that was his evenings. It wasn't even his evenings.
It was daytime stuff at weekends and stuff, probably, I guess.
Or... I guess he would do the weekends, and then he would go back to filming Family Ties in the week. And, yeah, absolutely crazy schedule. But he was filming Teen Wolf when Eric Stoltz was filming Back to the Future. And he was going, oh, I wish I wasn't in this shitty fucking werewolf film. I wish I was doing Back to the Future. And then he did Back to the Future. Back to the Future was a huge hit, and the makers of Teen Wolf went, right, let's release Teen Wolf. And we'll cash in on Michael J. Fox. And it's kind of, yeah. And his book, he's got another book out, and I'm sure he's written some others, but he wrote a book called Lucky Man, which is like a really sort of inspiring book. But like all of that stuff, like in terms of light comedy, all of that stuff that he did in Spin City when, so he got Parkinson's. I think it was brought on by the hanging sequence in Back to the Future 3. Where he was being dragged along the ground, he has a noose around his neck because they're going to hang him in the square, and then he gets sort of like dragged along by a horse, and something went wrong with the stunt, and it actually, I think he blacked out for a bit, and they think that something happened with his nerves or something, and when he was filming Doc Hollywood with Woody Harrelson. I think there was a thing where he had like his hand over his eyes. because I think he was, he had like a bit of substance abuse. I think he was in a, he was drinking a lot. And he had his hands over his eyes and his finger would flutter. And he thought it was like a moth or something. And his finger would flutter. And he was just like, well, there's something wrong. And he had this uncontrollable kind of like twitch in his hand. And he did, I don't know if he got it like checked out straight away, but it was kind of like this thing that grew and grew. And then by the time he found out, then he went back and he did Spin City. And if you rewatch Spin City, he's always moving. Like, he didn't tell anyone that he had Parkinson's for a very long time. And he's always moving in Spin City. He's always sort of like, literally, there's never a second where he's not moving. He'll get like, he'll be putting his hands in his pockets, taking his hands out of his pockets, picking up a pen, clicking a pen. And he's and you watch him and he's like a whirlwind. He walks into every scene and he's just always moving. And it was because he was trying to sort of like, it's like a really great performance in that sitcom. But he, it was partially because he was trying to hide the fact that he had Parkinson's from everyone. Yeah, like, interesting. But it's a really great book. Lucky Man, Michael J. Fox.
Great actor. Love him.
Great and underrated. I think he's kind of like, he's one of those actors that's known. And if he'd only done Marty McFly, that's fine. But, and people love that character and that film and that franchise, but specifically, I think, that film so much that that's all he ever needs to do. But he's good in pretty much everything. And like you were saying, that Brian De Palma film,
Casualties of War.
Casualties of War, and he did have depth. But I think you know, if you ever see Sean Penn, you know, they had so much sort of like rivalry on that set. If you ever see Sean Penn in a comedy, it's fucking awful, right? But Michael J. Fox, he could do the dramatic stuff, but the light stuff was just completely underrated.
I think that's true of a lot of people. A lot of people who are very good actors really struggle in comedies. They just can't really pull it off. It's just something that they haven't got in them.
It's that lightness. I think they're different skills. That intensity is very difficult to like find, which I guess is why a lot of people go method. But and I guess that's why those actors are the ones that really sort of like, you know, I don't know how much of that there is anymore. It feels like there's a lot of people with abs that are film stars because it's good to be chiseled. But I don't, you know, we're not living in an age of movie. I heard something in the week where they were like saying there aren't movie stars anymore. What you've got instead of movie stars is you've got Marvel. Marvel is a movie star. People will go and see any Marvel film, but they won't necessarily go and see any Chris Hemsworth film.
I think that's true, yeah. And I think they're all trying to get other projects off the ground, but it does feel like, and a lot of them are very good, you know, a lot of the people in them. I like Chris Hemsworth a lot when I see him in stuff.
He's brilliant.
I saw Extraction this week, actually.
Yes.
It's on Netflix, and he's really good in it. I don't know, like, there's loads of good things about the film. It's really well made. And it's a Netflix film, and it feels really cinematic, actually, for a film that's made for Netflix. And it's one of those ones where it almost makes you think it's a bit of a waste that it never got a cinema release, really. And yet Netflix are the people behind it. It's almost like they're now making these sort of... And the action's really good. He's really great in it. And he plays the character as Australian, which he is, and it sort of adds something to it. So it almost seems quite unusual as a leading man to be not just have an Australian accent, but there's something quite Australian about the performance, it seems. And he seems a little bit less, it doesn't feel very Hollywoodish. It feels a bit like, he's a bit like, it feels like he's a bit more of just a regular bloke in it. It's not a brilliant film by any means. And it's a little bit, it's kind of got that weird thing where it's set in, it's all set in like Bangladesh and parts of India, and Mumbai it's set in, goes between the two. And so it's like it's him fighting people, but of course everyone he fights are brown people, and it always feels a bit, it's got that kind of, visually, it doesn't look good.
Yeah.
It's that thing, it looks a bit...
It's like Rambo, where it's kind of like, yeah, sure, I mean, he is in Vietnam, or yeah, sure, he is in Burma, but... Yeah, sure, he is in... Actually, in Rambo 3, they were all Russians, weren't they? But, like, but you go, aren't they a bit racist? And then you go, yeah, I don't know. I think that, it doesn't feel not racist, but
yeah. I don't think the intention was. I just think visually it's not a good look.
Absolutely, the intention for Chris Hemsworth making this film was not let's make a racist film, right?
I don't think that was his.
80% guarantee that they did not set out to make a racist film.
Yeah. It's a bit of a shame because it's really well done. It just is one of those films where you come away from it a bit like, yes, right. It's not, by all means, it's not a bad film.
But it's like True Lies as well, where it's just kind of like, right, well, we are just going to be, killing terrorists and they're all brown people. But what we'll do is we'll have someone on the team that comes from the same background, and then they're the comic relief, and we'll all like him. So that means it's all right to kill all the others.
Yeah.
And I think that Hollywood has got a huge problem with that anyway, and it comes all the way back from the cowboys and Indian days. So it's just kind of like it's just the way that they made films for ages. It's good that people aren't making films like that anymore, and it's good that it got called out on it. Because because Extraction was really controversial. Like everyone kicked off about it. I don't know how much of that is people.
Oh, I've missed any controversy about it.
Oh, it was really controversial. It was like everyone called it. Well, I don't know how much of it is like the media that's like whipping it up, because there's literally nothing to report on this year other than Corona and Trump. And so it's kind of like, I don't know how much of that is also people on Twitter. Wokeness and all this stuff. It's just kind of like, there is, I think some people miss context and they want something to be angry about. But I think it's good to, I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I know exactly what you're talking about in terms of like action films have got a long history of that.
But to go back, he's got that thing in it where you go, what a movie star. Great. He kind of looks great. He feels like he's funny. He's got all the goods that in another age should be a massive star. But essentially he's just Thor trying to get something else off the ground.
Well, yeah, but also coming back to that, I mean, the Rocky franchise has been kind of like accused of racism in the past because he's always beating up a black guy.
Hmm. That's part of the first one, though, isn't it? That's part of the... It comes into it.
The guy that wrote it, he wasn't a movie star. He was white, and he wrote it, and he was in it. So, and a lot of boxers are black. So to have him fighting white people would be kind of like whitewashing it. Mm. But he has to be the lead because it's his vehicle. So it's kind of like... And then the sequel is a repeat, so it's Apollo Creed again. And the third one is like, it's Mr. T, and you go, right, well, he's only beating up two black guys. But it's like been over three films now. And so the fourth one is like, well, get a Russian this time. I have seen 5 and 6 this week, so I might talk about that in a little bit.
He loses the first one, of course, as well.
He does lose.
The first one, isn't it? It's the Apollo Creed character wants it to be, is almost trying to find mould. A new white boxer, because he sort of feels that the audience is going, because they feel like they want almost the Apollo Creed is cynically after a white boxer to bring back a kind of white audience to boxing.
Sort of. He's like, he wants to beat up a white guy it's not American Independence Day, is it? It's like some sort of... He comes in just as George Washington and everything. I don't know. I just think that somebody told me in a pub that they thought, without seeing any of the Rocky films, I think they'd read a Guardian article and they'd said, Rocky's racist. And I said, I don't think it is. I think it's trying to be accurate to the sport that it's portraying, but it just happens to be written by a white guy. And so, I don't know. I've just seen them all, and at no point did I think this is racist. But then I also watched Eddie Murphy Raw, and he has that routine in it where he's talking about Italian guys after they've been to see a Rocky film. And it's a really funny routine. And then you go, well, obviously people were, it was before Rocky IV, so it was like there'd been three Rocky films that by the time Eddie Murphy made Raw. And so he was sort of like saying, it is always black guys though, isn't it? And so he was calling it out back then. And I think that they deliberately changed it by the fourth one and went, yeah, actually there is a, you have a point. But not to make it all about Rocky. So maybe we'll have a Rocky chat after the thing. Extraction. So would you recommend it?
Yeah, I think it's like it's a really good like action movie. I mean, what's the shame is it would have been a much better film were you able to watch it in the cinema, which is a shame. And I think given that experience, people might have enjoyed it a bit more in general. I think it's done really well for Netflix. It's got a sequel apparently in the pipeline and things.
Oh really?
It's really well choreographed, and the stunts are great, and all the kind of fight sequences are great, and they're really impressive as well. It's just that you come away from it a bit like it sort of leaves a bit of a bad taste in your mouth. You go, oh, okay, but you know, it's really well done.
Yeah, it was like the Rambo film, Last Blood, which wasn't a great film. It was a great Home Alone sequel. It was not a great film. But, like, yeah, you come away from it and you just feel like, that didn't feel not racist. I don't know how comfortable I felt watching it. The action was good, but it's just like you go, I don't believe that Stallone is racist. I'm not saying that. I don't think that it's like the Chris Hemsworth. I don't think that they deliberately set out to do it, but I just think that they were slightly naive, misguided, and maybe a bit ignorant, and that's just like,
yeah, there's a naivety to how people might view the film. I don't think there's anything going into it which is and you know, a lot of that's on me as well to go, oh, okay.
But also, if we're hyper aware, everyone's hyper aware at the moment, so you kind of like go, how were they not hyper aware? They made it in the same environment that we're watching it. So how's that a thing? You know, there's always a thing
where that's how the money. It's based on a, it's based on a graphic novel which is set, I think, somewhere in the Middle East. So they've changed the location anyway, and it might just be to do with like filming, or someone said, "Hey, we can get this." Or some people at the minute they're trying to get people to film in India and Bangladesh. Let's change a location, and we'll just. And someone goes, "Great idea!" And it probably just happened like that. Like
if they're filming. If it'll be two things, it'll either be access to the country, or it'll be whether they can get any tax breaks and it'll be cheaper. So it'll be one or the other. If they're changing the location like that, but it was like when they did the Aladdin film, the Guy Ritchie Aladdin movie, and they colour corrected all of the extras so that they all looked like Arabs, but they were like white people on set, and then they just digitally made them brown, and you kind of like go, well, you can't do that. What you know? This is Disney. This is the biggest company. It was the biggest company on the planet. So it's like, what you if you're not aware, but that was like a couple of years ago now, when and that was really controversial. It's like Extraction would have been made after that. I don't know. Yeah, I haven't seen it, but it was controversial. But also, I think it is because everyone is sort of like hypersensitive and hyper aware at the moment, and just people are calling stuff out. I don't know. I don't feel like I'm the... I'm anti-racism, guys, just in case you need that pointed out. But I also don't feel like I'm the expert.
No. I mean, I guess how you feel. I mean, I certainly felt a bit... like, a little bit uncomfortable watching it. So it is like... And I wasn't aware of any controversy about it.
Yeah, but if you felt... If you felt uncomfortable... Then everyone felt uncomfortable, or most people felt uncomfortable. I don't know. And then some people can have that amazing ability to just switch their brains off and just enjoy stuff for possibly the way it was intended. But there's that nagging doubt. You think, you're kind of like, I hope it was intended like this.
It's entirely likely that they do a sequel to it and you go, well, that's great. Because it feels like like they're trying to do a kind of fun, good, it's violent as well, very violent action franchise, and it's quite fun. He's fun in it. He's good.
Oh, it's nice watching people explode on film. It's great. We got to. I mean, that half hour has gone by really quickly, hasn't it?
It has.
Let's play the song now.
Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. We are back. We're back in the kitchen. So, have you seen anything else this week?
I've seen too much, if anything, Nick. I've seen millions of things. Let's talk about Rockies, because that was finishing a thing from last week, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I'll do it really briefly, and then, well, I finished Bly Manor. And I just, I don't really remember any of it. It was sort of a House on Haunted Hill. No, what was it called? The Haunting of Hill House. Mm. I thought that's really stuck with me. It's 9 episodes, is it? Or 8 episodes? I think it was 9 episodes. The first 8 episodes of that were great. And then Bly Manor hasn't stuck with me at all. And yeah, I just think it's, anyway, it's there's some absolutely bizarre choices in it where you kind of like, a lot of this doesn't work, but there's some, it's just weird. Although I love Henry Thomas.
I've been meaning to watch more of it and I kind of want to finish it off, but it's been a week and I've probably seen another one and you go, it feels like my patience with it is quite small. Like it feels a bit like an effort.
It was an effort. It was like literally, Natalie was saying that she'd watched the first episode or the second episode and she was like, I don't know if I can be bothered. And I'd got to the sixth episode and I was like, well, I'm going to watch the last three, but if you're only two episodes in, I wouldn't bother. It's a weird one. Anyway, so I started watching Ratched this week.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's got a really good cast. It's got Judy Davis. It's got Amanda Plummer, who I recognised instantly. Even though she looks nothing like Amanda Plummer turns out. I go, that's Amanda Plummer. And it's like, who? And you go, either Pumpkin or Honey Bun from Pulp Fiction. And so that was quite cool. And then it's got Sarah Paultan in it, who's done loads of stuff. Oh, I watched Split last night and Sarah Paultan was in that as well. Split. No, not Split. Glass. That's what I watched last night.
Wow, I could talk about that.
Fuck me. What a movie, am I right? Yeah. We've got the same taste on a lot of things. It's such a good film, isn't it, Nat? Yeah, I can predict what you're going to say. Five stars, a five-star classic. M. Night Shyamalan's done it again.
Bonkers. It's bonkers. It's like every choice you've made, you've gone, what? It's not even just why. There's a lot of what about it. Like, that's a terrible... Imagine if you're a big fan of Unbreakable and you're like, finally, the new Unbreakable film, and you watch it like that. If you think like the sort of
climax to Split
set up all the way through doesn't happen, and it's
what's the climax? What's the climax? What is the climax meant to be? What do you think?
All the way along, don't they? About there's going to be this big thing. Is it at the Empire State Building? They're talking about having this big fight.
It's in Philadelphia. There's this big CGI building in the middle of Philadelphia that they've kind of made like the Avengers building. And they're going to go, because there's a thing, they say this building is a marvel. And it's kind of like heavily implied that it's the Avengers building in Philadelphia. And so what, they're going to go there and destroy it?
That's like, yeah, they've got this big sort of, but it's talked about all the way through it. Like, okay, so this is what we're leading up to, this big sort of, and it sort of ends in like a car park instead.
The whole film is filmed in cells and corridors. And then at the end, the big climax is in a car park. And you go, oh, and you've got McAvoy doing his acting showreel all the way through it. And it's just kind of like, what is this? And like, yeah, like you say, I was going to say I liked the links to Unbreakable. I think what you just got to accept is Unbreakable is one standalone movie and it's absolutely does its job and it's not as memorable as The Sixth Sense, but you kind of, if you've seen The Sixth Sense too many times, watch Unbreakable. It sort of does the same thing in a bit, in a different genre. But like, Split was, I've got one word review for Split.
It rhymes with Split.
Right. And then Glass, I've got one word for review for that as well. Right.
Glass?
It does rhyme with right. Glass. I don't know why I watched it. I think it's because I was on my own last night. And I thought, I'll watch something that will have no bearing on my relationship. It'll be something, she won't want to watch this, so I'll just watch it. And I was like, what a wasted evening. fuck it.
A weird film.
But Sarah Paulton's in it. Oh, no, I thought I'd left the meeting.
Spoilers, but I mean, if you haven't seen Glass and you want to cover your ears for a minute. But to have the character from Unbreakable basically ends by drowning in a puddle.
It's like, what? You just drowned Bruce Willis in a puddle? What? In a car park? In a shit?
It feels like
M. Night Shyamalan went, I've reinvented you, Bruce Willis, in The Sixth Sense. And 20 years later, fuck you. I'm just going to drown you. I can make your career. I can end it.
It's another one like we talked about Once Upon a Time in Mexico, where it feels like everyone signed up for a couple of days. They've all done their bit. And they've he's tried to edit a film together, cutting bits of film together, there you go. Here's my big sequel that you've all been waiting for.
He would have had so much creative control over that. And when he realised that, I can't blow up a building, you just go, just rewrite the entire film, mate. Just rewrite it. You know, it's crazy film. Anyway, so I started watching Ratched. I always thought her name was Nurse Ratched, but it's Nurse Ratched. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is weird because it's my favourite book. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is one of my favourite books. It is maybe my favourite book. The film, I think, is incredible, right? Absolutely incredible from beginning to end. What a movie. Ratched is a prequel series where you find... It's pointless, right?
That's my reason for not watching it. I wonder what happened to her when she was younger.
No, for my take on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you've got Nurse Ratched. She is an authoritarian. She's not evil, but she's sort of like one of those mums from the 80s that tried to ban heavy metal, you know? She's kind of like, I imagine she goes to church on a Sunday. She likes everything the way it is. And then she gets challenged by Jack Nicholson, R.P. McMurphy. And there's a very sort of subtle cat and mouse game where Jack Nicholson thinks that he is kind of like the man who's kicking against the fence, and he's kind of like pushing the authoritarians, and he's pushing the authority, and he's kind of like showing everyone that there's a better life. And what he doesn't realise the whole way through is that she is completely in charge. And her performance in that movie is she won an Oscar for it. Her performance in that movie, what's her name? Jessica?
Yeah, I can't think. No, it's gone.
Natalie? I want to say Jessica Fletcher, but it's not Jessica Fletcher. That's Murder, She Wrote. But her performance in that, she got an Oscar for it. It's just so subtle. She's not evil. She's not anything. She is evil. She's just got this cold, steely-eyed... she's not evil. She's the epitome of evil. It's incredible. It's incredible. And then you've got this series, which is called Ratched, which is really stylized. It looks absolutely fantastic, but there's not a single scene that really rings true. And it's kind of it's showing how she got her position I guess it's going to end with her getting a position in the place where One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is set. But it's like House of Cards, where she's sort of manipulating everyone. She's this puppet master, this arch villain that's coming. Everything is really arch and really kind of she's really fucked up. And she's getting people murdered and killing people. And you just sort of go... There is sort of an element of that. When Billy Bibbit, spoiler alert for a film that was made in the 70s, but when Billy Bibbit dies, she does manipulate that in a way to get at Jack Nicholson, to make a point with Jack Nicholson. But you get the feeling that she's been pushed to that. She hasn't spent her whole life murdering people in hospitals. She's not like a Halloween costume. Do you know what I mean? She's not a slasher villain. She's a sociopath. She's a psychopath. She's the epitome of evil, but everyday evil. And then you've got this Ratched thing, which looks absolutely phenomenal. It's got an amazing cast, and it's just kind of how did you make this based on watching that film? or based on reading that book, how have you come up with this?
Yeah, that's always my problem. Just the way it looked, I just went, well, it's never been an issue for me. It's never been like a question unanswered or anything. I never felt like there was more to it than what you got already.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like there's a need for it or like...
Well, it's like Prometheus. It's like this thing where you go, I get this. You've got... You know what? You've got like... you've got a brevity. Mm-hmm. What does brevity mean?
That's kind of shortening.
Yeah. You've got a brevity of information in the film, which benefits the storytelling. It's kind of like there's a shorthand to it where you understand everything, and it's actually economic. It's economic storytelling where you watch it and you've got all the information you need, and it's actually a real skill to do that. And so when you watch Alien and you see the space jockey and there's this... It's called Alien. It's not called fucking intergalactic space weapon. Do you know what I mean? It's called Alien. It's about an alien, right? It's about an alien species. So you see the space jockey and you instantly go, wow, imagine the size of this universe. So these things that we're not even going to talk about that have existed for centuries without our knowledge. And we're not even going to talk about that. And we're just going to, and it just makes the whole universe huge. And so to not go into that shows restraint, and you get all the information you need, and the film is perfect, right? And the same with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where it's just, you go, I don't need to know any more about these people because you've done the storytelling so well, I know who they are. So to go back and then just explain it, and then you go, did we watch the same fucking film? Is this what you dreamt of when you wanted to make it? It's bonkers that you've gone, I've taken this thing that's very subtle and I've made it into this. And I haven't read any reviews and I don't know what the popular opinion is or anything like that. But from my point of view, I was just like tutting at the screen the whole way through. Just like, but why would she do that? And that was very convenient. And, you know, she's like this fucking massive puppet master, who's manipulated every single element around her in order to get what she wants. And yeah, that is to work at a hospital. And you go, that is absolute... I mean, it's it feels like it's a betrayal of the character. We still don't know who the actress is that played Miss Ratched.
Is in the TV show, who I like. I think he's great. And I really like Amanda Plummer, actually.
Who do you like?
Amanda Plummer and Sarah Paulson. I like them both. So I like them both, but nothing about it made me think, oh, I must watch this, or... it just felt, yeah, like totally pointless to me. It just sort of felt like, and also it almost felt like it wasn't necessarily in the tone or the spirit of the film or anything. It didn't feel like it was a connection otherwise, other than it's like a name recognition.
Yeah.
Great, we've got another.
I can't stress how beautiful it is to look at. It looks absolutely incredible, but you just think this is just like, and also don't call it Ratched. Just if it was called anything else, and you've, and in actual fact, it works best when you forget it's got anything to do with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You know, yeah, but it's still kind of like very convenient. There's a bit when she steals some purses, and or she steals a purse, and it's kind of like, well, why would they have the purse on the counter with their back to it? It was just like, it's just all so convenient. And then you just like go, oh. Sarah Paulson, funnily enough, looks exactly like Embeth Davids, right? So Embeth Davids was in Army of Darkness. And then that same year, or maybe the next year, she went on to do Schindler's List. And Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell were like, can't believe we got her to be in Army of Darkness. You know, she's like delivering lines like, I may be bad, but I feel good. And you found me beautiful once. Honey, you got real ugly, right? And then the next year she did Schindler's List, and like, we would never have been able to get her. Like, even 6 months later, it's impossible. And then Sam Raimi made this series called American Gothic, which is a great series. And the woman that played the woman that played the main guy's sister...
Merle?
What's her name?
She's called Merle, wasn't she?
Marlin, wasn't it Marlin?
I think so. I could never work out what it was because it was always his accent. Like, Marley.
She was.
What's her name?
So I just always assumed that that was Embeth Davids because it looked exactly like Embeth Davids, but it's not. It's Sarah Paulson. So but because it's Sam Raimi, you just think, yeah, he's used the same actress from Arbor, but she looks exactly. So apparently, even though I doubt that there's that much of an age difference, if you see them side by side, it's almost impossible to work out who is who. But Embeth Davids played the teacher in Matilda. And there's some sort of like online campaign to get Sarah Paulson to play a younger, whatever the teacher's called.
Okay.
Like in a prequel to Matilda or something. And it's just kind of like, well, she can't be that much younger than Embeth Davids, but also she's much older than Embeth Davids when Embeth Davids made Matilda. It's like, it's crazy. It's crazy. Anyway, 5 minutes on Rocky 5 and 6. Rocky 5, everyone hates Rocky 5. Stallone is a populist, right? If someone says, oh, that film is shit, he either goes off box offices or popular opinion. And he never says anything surprising like, actually, I think I'm quite good in Stop or My Mum Will Shoot. He always just throws everything under the bus if people don't like it. And people didn't like Rocky V, and so he's always thrown it under the bus. And you go, actually, it's 90% a brilliant sequel to Rocky. I think there's so much good stuff. It feels like it's a real return to the franchise after Rocky IV. Rocky is probably the best. Oh, I'll get to the end. So I think Rocky V is great. And then the ending is so sort of like, you go, you can't end the franchise with a punch up in the street, with a street fight. You can't end the franchise like this.
When I was a kid, though, that was the selling point of Rocky V, was that it was all street fighting. It was out of the ring. And I remember that being the thing, like, oh, it's a proper one, is it? It's a proper, yeah, it's not boxing, it's street fighting.
But when you watch it in the context of the entire series, you go, that's everything that the franchise is against, right? Rocky isn't like this guy. He's not a thug that goes around beating people up in the street. He's a professional fighter. Mm-hmm. And he's got a lot of heart. And so for the franchise in 1990 to end like that, you kind of like go, Rocky V isn't the problem. The last 10 minutes of Rocky V is the problem. And I think it's such a good film. His relationship with Sage Stallone in that is great. I just think it brings all the drama back. There was no drama in Rocky IV. It was all sort of like pumped up to 11, and it was all montages and all kind of, it was so glossy. It's a great film.
It's but Sage Stallone at school, right, with the little girl he makes friends with. And
yeah. He makes like a gang of friends, and he gets sort of, Stallone, Rocky kind of gives all of his attention to Tommy Gunn. And it's just really good. There's not a lot of action or fighting in it, and it's all drama, and it's family drama. And they just sort of like return it to its roots. And I like seeing Rocky in a tiny little kitchen sat around with his family eating. I like the fall from grace, and it sort of works better in that context when he's striving for something than when he's got it all in Rocky III and he's just trying to keep hold of it. And then 16 years later, you have Stallone went like, okay, fine. That was a terrible way to end the franchise. Everyone hates Rocky V. So he made Rocky Balboa, which is sort of like this amazing meta autobiographical film where Stallone went, people, by the end of the 90s, which is weird because he made Copland late 90s, where he was great, but no one went to see it, and he hated making it because he had to put on all that weight. But he's so good in that. But by the end of the 90s, early 2000s, he was doing stuff like Driven, which was Rocky with race cars, and Detox, Avenging Angelo, which is like this terrible romantic comedy with Madeline Stowe.
I've never heard of that.
Avenging Angelo. It's this awful romantic comedy where he plays a mobster's bodyguard who who falls in love with his daughter.
That's passed me by entirely.
It's terrible. It's like straight to video. It's not terrible, but it's sort of like it's a comedy without any laughs, and there's no action in it. He made Get Carter. He had sort of like a small part in Shade. So he was kind of like straight to video. It was a joke. Nobody liked him. And then he said, I'm going to make another Rocky film. And then everyone was like, you're fucking kidding, right? And that's what the plot of the film is. Like Rocky saying, I'm going to go for one more fight. And everyone's going, you're fucking joking, right? And I think Rocky VI is not as well directed as Rocky IV. It's not as good in terms of what it is. Very sort of like clunky. It's very sort of like meat and veg. He's put a film together with his big sausage hands and he's kind of like gone, this is it. It's kind of a little bit like Glass in a way, where he's kind of like, what have we got? What are we working with? This is our budget. This is our time restraint. I'm going to put this film together. And it works so well. The speeches are incredible. He brings something new to all of the fight scenes in terms of aesthetics, like how the film looks, feels like it's a real fight.
It feels like more of an indie film almost, doesn't it? Has that kind of modern kind of indie feel.
Yeah, it's when you watch them all in a row, it's like a totally different beast to the other films. But it is, I think it is just insanely good. There's so many great speeches in it. I just love it. So I would say, wrapping it up, Rocky One is the best. But either joint best or followed very, very soon, you know, very near, is Rocky Balboa. Rocky Five has got... It's just a really good sequel to the first Rocky, I think, except for the last 10 minutes. And then Rocky Four is the best directed. And then you've got Rocky Two, which is like a rehash, but it's still very... I've got a lot of time for it. And then Rocky Three, which is like, nah, I'm all right. So that's it. And I've got, like, I might see the Creeds. They're sort of like... It's sort of a different franchise, but I might see the Creeds next week and maybe just finish off and talk about them. But, I've quite liked this little exercise that I've invented. I think I'm the only person that's watched all the Rocky films and seen them all in a row. And then I'll do the Police Academies again. Right, let's do some... Anything to add, Nathaniel?
No, other than I think I recall liking the Creeds more than you did, but we'll see.
I just think Creed is a less rounded character. I think Rocky is one of the most likeable characters that has ever been created for film. And Creed has got a lot to sort of like live up to, and he's just not as likeable. I think that when you look at something like the Star Wars sequel trilogy, how to treat legacy characters and introduce a new character, you go, well, just look at Creed. They did it perfectly. You've got a new character who you do care about, but he's just slightly less likeable than... But that's because you spent a lot less time with him as well. So you've got this new character, and then you've got like the old character who turns up and he's like the mentor character. He's still got a story, but you're not disrespecting his legacy and what all the films that he made beforehand. It's kind of like it's the perfect way of bringing in, you know, creating a sequel sort of like franchise. When you look at the Star Wars trilogy sequels, you go, why didn't you just do what Creed did? You fucked this. You fucked it systematically over and over again for three movies, and now you haven't got a franchise anymore. Now you're starting from scratch. Whereas all you need to do is kind of like go, hey, all the guys that watch the originals, you can come in, but we're also trying to get a new audience. You know, that's how I feel. And if you don't agree with me, you can fuck off. So, we've got one piece of fan mail this week.
Okay.
That's a shame. Isn't it? That's a shame, because no one's telling their friends.
Oh, yeah, that's what it proves.
Oh, well. Come on, Brian. What have you got to say for yourself? Hey, Nick and Nat, how you doing? I'm just going to read your fan mail for you. Okay. Thanks for having me in every week, by the way. It's a real honour to be here. Got a new album coming out. Got a new album. It was not just the one song. It's a whole new album of AC/DC. So I hope you enjoy it when you get round to giving it a spin on you. I guess it's a turntable.
Right, yeah. That's what you have now, yeah. Okay.
Spin it on your MIDI disc. So here we go.
Nick and Nathaniel Metcalf. Hi, Nick and Nathaniel Metcalf. The play Nick saw with his family is called Beautiful Thing, which is a brilliant play. If a little awkward, I'll sit in next to your dad. I watched the film as a kid and I really recommend it. Not only a great gay coming-of-age film, but one of the few films I've seen that paints council estate living in a positive light, with a soundtrack featuring the mamas and the papas. It's a great fucking movie. All the best, Lewis.
It was. It was called Beautiful Thing. And I do remember it being a great play. And I thought, and I remember the set. The set was like, basically, it was like two or three stories of a council estate that was at the back of the thing, and it all took place there. It was a good play. I was 11.
For a movie, didn't they? There's a movie came out in the 90s of it.
That's what they're saying here. They're saying, right. I've seen the film. Didn't you hear Brian Johnson just say that?
Yes.
I did see that you sort of drifted off. It's fine. That's the pros and the cons of Zoom, isn't it? When you're having a conversation, you can actually see the dead eyes of a shark as the black eyes roll back to white. As Brian Johnson reads out another fan mail. It's great. It's great. It was just very awkward as an 11 or 12-year-old boy sat next to his entire family listening about being masturbated with peppermint foot lotion when you know for a fact that your dad hadn't done any research into what he was taking his wife to see on her birthday. It was news to all of us as it was unfolding, and you go, great. But, and that is all our fan mail.
Right in.
Please. Third Rudder Fan Club, please, for the love of God, write in. Okay, let's play a song.
Well done.
Smile.
Tom and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're back. We're back live. We're not live. We're pre-recording. And we're in the studio. We're not in the studio. We're in my kitchen. And Nat is in his washroom. So there we go. And answers on a postcard. It was Louise Fletcher from... Not Jessica Fletcher, the character from Murder, She Wrote. But it was Louise Fletcher, the Oscar-winning actress who was in Exorcist 2 and Invaders from Mars. So here we go. Right, we're now joined by a very prolific actor, Miranda Raisin. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, and thank you for calling me prolific.
You are prolific. We were going through your CV, and you've done fucking loads.
A couple of those things, I have to say, were like my cousin hiring me to do an episode of Emmerdale when I was starting out. There are a couple of credits on there that were definitely sort of charity at the beginning.
That's my entire CV. It still counts. Yeah, absolutely. So you're currently in season 2 of Warrior, which is on Sky One on Wednesdays at 10 p.m. So what we tend to do is we try to get the plug out the way right at the top, and then we just have a chat. So do you want to tell us a little about that? You weren't in the first season of Warrior.
No, I wasn't. I joined series 2. My first episode was actually last night, and I play Nellie Davenport, who's based on a real woman, actually, who was called Donaldina Cameron, who rescued the Chinese, I say underage prostitutes, I mean, they were child prostitutes, from the crib brothels in San Francisco. So Warrior's all set in the Tong Wars of San Francisco in the 1880s. And yeah.
Is it right that this is like a concept, this is like an old Bruce Lee concept?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it was his idea, his passion. He wrote a kind of rough draft of it all, and he was supposed to do it. And then they cast it with a white man. They cast David Carradine and called it Kung Fu.
Kung Fu the series?
Yes. So actually it bears very little to no resemblance of Kung Fu. But
Kung Fu was sort of like a prototype for stuff like Knight Rider, where it's like a guy that goes from town to town doing stuff.
Right. Well, there's still, I mean, really it bears so little resemblance. But R. Sam, the main character, is played by Andrew Koji, who's kind of the Bruce Lee character. And Shannon Lee, Bruce Lee's daughter, is one of the executive producers. But he does play a kind of, he's sort of, almost the wandering warrior.
And during all the kind of Tong Wars, but I guess that's something that you're kind of familiar with in kind of old, I guess, 60s and 70s movies, but then it always has that kind of air of being a bit imperialist, and this is probably a much more modern take on it.
Much more modern, and also this is very much told from the point of view, really, of the Chinese. This is their story. It's not just, you know, where you've got kind of the Chinaman who feeds the bodies to pigs kind of thing. Not that that character in Deadwood isn't amazing, but, you know, this is very much told from a point of view that we haven't heard before, and a very kind of politically important point of view.
And it's also interesting that you think of all this stuff that happening in the world at the same time. So you in Britain, I guess it's a kind of Victorian era Britain. And in America, you've got the Old West happening at the same time.
Yeah. And you've got the Irish immigrants. And, yeah, there's a lot going on, a lot of potential conflict
everywhere. And the Chinese immigrants were building all of the train tracks from one side of America to the other.
Yeah.
What's it like stepping into, like, a second series where you weren't involved in the first series?
So I was a bit nervous, because everybody kept talking about how lovely everyone was and how it was like family. And that just brought out my English kind of skeptic. I was like, oh God, everyone's going to hate each other. But actually it was amazing. Everyone was completely welcoming. It's the biggest set. I mean, I've done, you know, a few kind of big projects, but this was a set where they had built streets. They built a town basically in Cape Town Studios. And so kind of stepping on for the first day, you know, I don't know if I can I swear on here?
Yeah.
Okay, so the horse shit was real, like real horse shit from last year as well as this year, the kind of straw and the flies and the everything. And so in a way, the scale of it was so huge that when it got to, because I shot almost straight after I arrived, you were kind of in it straight away. And it was, you know, there was no time for weird politics.
When you say you're in it, you don't actually mean specifically the horse shit.
I'm sure there was some horse. I'm sure the wardrobe department had to work pretty hard after anyone shot in Chinatown.
Does it have to be that realistic?
Well, you know, it works. It does actually work. And apparently the horse shit looked much better in season two because a lot of it was caked and old. It's the kind of thing that, you know, that HBO incredibly dedicated scene builders matter. Yeah, yeah, they were thrilled about that.
There's a horse wrangler in the credits.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, he may be called something slightly more glamorous, but that's what he is.
I don't see why. Yeah, so you weren't replacing anyone. It was a new character for this season.
It's a new character and a new love interest for Olivia Cheng's character. She plays Artoy, who's this sort of powerhouse, amazing woman who runs a brothel, but not one of the brothels that Nelly is rescuing girls from. Her brothel is a lot more elite. and she's, yeah, they are from completely different worlds, but at the same time, they're kind of quite a good match for each other. And I think actually how it transpired was when Jonathan Tropper, the creator, when they were talking about how to find a man for Artoy that could kind of match her and be a good love interest for her, they couldn't think of anyone because so much of her life had been, you know, she'd been messed around so much in her life and abused and everything. They thought there was no way they could really do that with a man, so they weren't women.
It's interesting though, you're dealing with real people as well, so you have to get a kind of fictionalized account of people that existed. Do you feel the kind of responsibility there, or I guess the writers must do? It sounds like they're thinking about it a lot.
Yeah. What about the real original character versus the? I mean, I think so. Donaldina Cameron actually died in the 1960s, so she was several decades later, not very long after, but several decades after Nelly. And I think beyond, well, so you do see the vineyards in Sonoma, and you see, and you have to kind of, there is data, there are autobiographies of Donaldina Cameron, but I don't think that she had a raging love affair with a Chinese brothel owner. And I think there was a certain amount right from the beginning of just, you know, it's almost like the graphic novel version of a character.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I guess everyone, I mean, given time, everyone kind of ends up being essentially like they're almost like they're into the kind of public domain, don't they? And they sort of become their own.
Right.
I guess it's a legend, isn't it? It becomes like a legend or a fable based on real people and whatever truth there was to people of, you know, Robin Hood or whatever becomes like a
exactly,
legend.
And Wild Bill and all those kind of, they become their own odyssey.
Wow, yeah. One of the things I noticed you were also in, outside of that, was you were in Death on the Nut. No, you weren't in Death on the Nut, you're in Murder on the Orient Express a couple of years ago with Kenneth Branagh.
Well, I wasn't exactly in it. This is how much I was in it. I filmed quite a few days on it, but in the final cut, my mother, having watched it, said, "Did you have a plait for a moment? Was that you?" That's how much I was in Murder on the Orient Express.
I'm friends with Gemma Whelan, who's a really great actress, and she filmed in the movie Wolfman. She was on set every single day.
Oh, yeah, with Jack Nicholson, was that?
No, that's Wolf.
No. Oh,
okay. Wolfman was Benicio del Toro and Anthony Hopkins. And Gemma Whelan filmed like every single day. And I managed to get my mum to go and see it with me. And I said, "You know Gemma Whelan, do you want to go and see a period movie with Gemma Whelan?" It was Wolfman. And she's in one scene. But there's a carriage where she was in the entire... She was in this whole funeral scene, but she never left the carriage. So you see the carriage. She's like, "I was in the carriage." It's like, so, but how many days did you do on Murder on the Orient Express?
I think I did 10 days, which isn't a lot in the scheme of a huge shoot. But in terms of what you can actually shoot over 10 days, there's quite a lot of material. But actually, they ended up... the stuff that we'd shot was kind of replaced with a slightly different story. They used the beginning of the film was going to be one thing, but it turned out to be the sort of the wrapping up of Poirot's last case.
Right.
So I think they've sort of made it anyway.
But you worked with Kenneth Branagh. Was that at the Globe?
No, it was at
the Garrick Theatre.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
You did The Winter's Tale with Kenneth Branagh and Dame Judi Dench.
Yes.
We'll do a bit of biography stuff, like early days. But like, what was that like? What was that
That was amazing. So go on.
At what point in your career was that? And
So that was, it was actually the last play that I did. It was about 4 years ago. So it was just before I had my daughter, and I haven't done a play since I had her because I can't bring myself to do it yet. But it was, I just said to my agent that I didn't want to do another play because I'd just done some theatre and I wanted to do some more filming. And he said, you'll go, you're meeting for this, that we're not having this conversation. Sure. You're going for this. And I think part of it's fear when it's a big thing. It was Hermione. So, I mean, she's sort of a huge part in Winter's Tale and kind of, there are sort of four leads, I suppose, in the play, and she's one of them. And I knew Judi Dench and Kenneth Branagh were doing it, and he was directing it, and he was, you know, and I think there's sometimes a bit of fear that kicks in where you go, if I don't go for it, I'll never have failed. Sure. And I'd already done a terrible audition for him a few years before to play Lady Macbeth. It was not a good audition.
I find auditions I think most people find them horrific. Why was it a bad audition?
So I can't remember why, but I had to come. It was a last minute thing, and I was with my mum in Norfolk, so I had to get like the King's Lynn train into London on like a, you know, whatever it was, but it was sort of just took forever, and so I had all this time to kind of, what I love to do before an audition is kind of go for a run or go and do something or meet a friend, just do something to kind of bleh, and then, you know, you kind of go in fresh. I had all this kind of time on the King's Lynn train sort of to work myself up. And then I walked in and I wanted it so much. And I just walked in and thought, I'm not good enough to be here. The yips, they call it, don't they, in sport.
Was that the first time that you'd met Kenneth Branagh?
No, I actually had a small part in My Week with Marilyn. I played secretary of his office, and he played Laurence Olivier. Mm-hmm. So we had sort of met briefly, but, you know, I'm sure he didn't remember. He never said, oh, yes, it's you again. It was just, you know, it was one of those things that just wasn't meant to be.
And did you bring that up with him that you auditioned?
Nope. ever. In a 5-month run, I never mentioned
it. The Winter's Tale is that one of the problem plays?
Yes.
I studied Winter's Tale. I think it was A levels. It wouldn't have been GCSE. It would have been A levels. So I can't remember if we studied it in drama or English. It's not my favourite.
Can I ask what the problem play, what that refers to?
Well, go on, Miranda, you take it away.
This is the completely non-literary explanation of it, but it's sort of one that finishes and you go, huh? Am I meant to feel sad or happy or what? It's not a comedy, it's not a tragedy, it's somewhere in between. I love them because to me it's sort of like life, you know, is neither one or the other. It's sort of bittersweet. But people can pitch them very differently. That's my take on it, which anybody, feel free to write in to the show and say what crap I'm talking.
A good ending, right? Almost the best endings are ones where you have a bit of a question mark at the end.
Well, yes. Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
So that's the one with, is it Exit Pursued by Bear?
Yes.
So how did you do that?
How did they do that?
It's like a favourite. So for anyone who doesn't know, because we only talk about Rocky films, basically. for anyone who doesn't know that's listening, there's this really famous... Winter's Tale is one of Shakespeare's plays. And there's a very famous stage direction where it just says, Exit, Pursued by Bear. And it's basically open for interpretation. And then a lot of the time it's kind of there's a blackout and a sound effect, or there's someone that comes in dressed as a... It's sort of like, for Shakespeare nerds, it's kind of like, I guess it's one of the reasons to see the show. It's kind of like, the show, that's what we call them. it's kind of like, how are they going to interpret this stage direction?
It's a bit like, which actually Maggie Smith famously played Lady Bracknell in... the importance of being earnest, and the famous line, a handbag.
Yeah.
And I went to see it, and I was, like, waiting for it, and she just said, a handbag.
Yes.
And I think it was obviously a choice, because she knew that everybody would be waiting, and she actually just said it like you would say a line, like you would say a normal thing, saying it. And I think there was an echo of that with the Pursued by Bear, but I can't actually remember what we did, but I think it was downplayed.
I literally had a conversation with someone this week about Lady Bracknell, and so I saw Patricia Routledge on stage.
Oh, amazing.
And I think it was in the West End. So I saw Patricia Routledge as Lady Bracknell in The Importance of Being Earnest. And then I saw the film with Rupert Everett and Colin Firth and Judi Dench. And the two performances, that is like the big line. And so you got Patricia, Patricia Routledge on stage, and she's just like... And then you've got Judi Dench, and she just literally, she doesn't even move her mouth. She just goes, a handbag. And you go like, oh, yeah, it's great. Right. And it's kind of like you take that one thing and you can learn. I think you can learn a lot about an actor.
But there must be so much pressure on them as well. They must have to try and do it differently.
Well, yeah.
It's such a...
Either that or there's been a long enough time. So Judi Dench had played Hermione before, but a long time before. So there was this whole thing, because there's a long time, for anyone who doesn't know the play, there's a long time where Hermione is frozen as a statue, and everybody thinks that she's dead and that this is a statue of her. So as an actor, you have to stand there for a very, very long time before there is the reveal that actually it is Hermione and she didn't die. And it's sort of, it's the moment kind of thing. And everyone was talking about what posture to have. And I said to Judi Dench, how did you stand? And she sort of said, well, darling, I just sort of did this. And so that's what I did. And nobody, it was luckily enough time had passed that nobody sort of saw it as plagiarism. And there was no YouTube of when she played Hermione, so I got away with it.
But it's sort of like a tip of the hat, isn't it? It's kind of like, it's like honouring a previous performance.
Well, you're not going to go, do you know what, I think I'll probably make better choices than the dame.
I'd have told her to fuck off and get American. So I mean, the fact that you, I think there's only so many ways that you can stand still on stage for prolonged periods of time.
Oh, it is a good moment though. It's a good moment because if you can do it right, which they did, they really lit to help me and everything. So it really does look like a wax. It looks like a Madame Tussauds. And then when there's that moment, that kind of breath and move, the audience kind of go,
and you're in control of that.
Yes. Yeah.
So that was sort of like you were buzzing, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was partly thinking, please don't fall down the step. Please don't fall down the step. But buzzing, totally.
Yeah. And then go on.
I was going to say that production, was that part of when Kenneth Branagh sort of took over the character?
Yeah.
Didn't he? Like a year, was it? He
did. Yeah, I think it was a year.
Was that the year he did The Entertainer?
Yes,
yeah, that's
he did
what
The Entertainer after.
That's what I saw.
Yeah. I think that was the last in the series, and we did the first. So we actually did two plays. We did Harlequinade, which is a Rattigan play, and that one. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, he took it over for a long time.
And so you've performed at the Globe as well. I own a brick of the Globe.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. My dad got me and my sister a brick each when Sam Wanamaker was rebuilding. Yeah. Sam Wanamaker, if you don't know, he is the bad guy in Raw Deal. Sam Wanamaker rebuilt the Globe Theatre in the early 90s, was it?
Yes. He was also the father of Zoe Wanamaker and the director of many Columbos and other things.
Well, the character, he's in... last year, he was a character in the Quentin Tarantino film.
Oh, was he?
He was. Yeah. He was the director. He was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's the director of the cowboy film that Leonardo DiCaprio is in. And it's weird because it's Sam Wanamaker. There's a guy that's playing Sam Wanamaker.
And it's the guy who was Spider-Man, wasn't it, in the 70s?
Right. Okay. Well, there you go. That's fan club. So I own a brick there, and you've performed there. So we're very similar in terms of what we've achieved with our lives.
Kindred spirits, yeah.
So what was it like performing at the Globe?
So the Globe is about, I think it's my favourite venue. I played Anne Boleyn in a new play by Howard Brenton at the Globe called Anne Boleyn. And it was the first new play ever to sell out there. And so we actually brought it back again the following year. And performing outdoors on a warm night with a packed house in a place like that, you know, occasionally you can hear the old helicopter sort of circling right over the Thames nearby, but even that kind of adds to it. It's the most incredible, incredible feeling. It just, I have nothing but fond memories of working there.
Because the audience are all standing.
Yeah, so there's lots of seats, and then you have 400 standing, which are called, they're called the groundlings. And they pay, I think it's £5. It might have changed now.
Right.
And then you have, yeah, there's lots of seating as well. Otherwise, right. My parents would not have come.
Or less for a seat.
Oh, pay more.
Like a seat. I've always just sort of assumed it is all standing. It's kind of like made me a bit scared of seeing anything.
No, you can buy a seat to bring a cushion.
Well, I've already got a brick. Do you think I should get a discount? I've got a certificate and everything. It says, I'm a pretty cool dude.
That's a lovely present.
It's, when you're at the Globe and you see everyone standing, do you feel that there's a little bit of pressure to sort of like rush through it a bit?
Well, so what was really nice about that play was it starts with Anne Boleyn walking on stage with a bag, and she talks to the audience straight away. So Howard Brenton just, you know, kick that kind of the fourth wall away. And she says, do you want to see it? Who wants to see it? And the audience sort of, you know, a few happy Globe goers say, I do. And then she pulls out her own head, and they've done a really good mold of my head, just severed. Mm. And so it begins with her showing the audience her head, and then sort of flashbacks to what's ensued.
Is there a lighting rig at the Globe?
Yeah, there is a rig. Well, sort of. It's actually, there has to be because it gets dark, but it's not, you're not that aware of it. But no, there is a rig, and we have beautiful lighting on stage. They have very clever ways of doing lighting on stage, as if lighting a room or something.
How would they have lit the Globe originally?
Torches, which is why so many actors caught fire, which isn't a joke.
Right.
Yeah, they did. They used to, the floodlights at the front of the stage were naked flames, and people's old dusty costumes used to go up, and
so presumably
theatres burnt down.
It's a new play at the Globe. It was written to be in that environment. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. Howard Brenton had written it for the Globe. I mean, it wouldn't have to be performed there. If they want to resurrect it anywhere else, he's very delighted. But in fact, they did tour it. I didn't do the tour, but... He did very much write it with knowing the theatre.
Do you, because of the times that we're living in, do you miss how do you feel about the fact that, you know, we've got 400 people crammed in together watching a play, and now that is kind of like an impossibility?
It's just, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen, but... The other day, I did a reading of The Odyssey with 72 other actors, and it was on Zoom, and it was for 12 hours reading. So, I mean, we just did a section each, and there were David Threlfall, and quite a lot of actors did it. And my slot was like 11:20 p.m., like near the very end of the book. And just before, you know, you kind of go into a little waiting room area, and it wasn't actually Zoom, it was sort of, but it was streaming live onto YouTube. And there was this kind of anticipation, and you were in the waiting room with other people, and then the reading. And as soon as it was done, I just felt incredibly depressed. It was just the other day, and I just thought, that's such a tiny bit of what the theatre is, you know, that sort of the buzz, the adrenaline, the feeling of kind of camaraderie, the feeling anything might happen, it could all go wrong, all that stuff. And it was so tangible. And I thought, when are we going to have that again? I don't know. So the answer is I have no idea.
Mm. Well, we're both stand-up comedians, and so it's kind of... It's the same thing. Oh, but I'm doing some filming at the moment, where we're doing some sort of stand-up, and the social distancing on how we all are on set, and we're sort of like watching people doing stand-up from an audience, and we're socially distanced as an audience. It's just sort of like there's no energy.
Yeah, right.
It's just a really good... Because for stand-up to work, you need to be in like a hot room, like perfect COVID conditions. You need to be in a hot room. You need to be packed right next to each other. You just need to be hot and sweaty, and it's like laughter is infectious, and when you're miles away from each other, there's no energy, and you're not like thriving off all the other people in the room, and it doesn't feel like it's an event, and it's sort of like I don't know how I feel, because I have an odd relationship with live work, but it's crazy, isn't it? I don't really have a point. Yeah.
Do you find that people laugh in a distanced way? Is there some like overcompensatory laughter as well to make it even more awkward? Or is it more just that people don't have the courage to laugh, not en masse? Or
I don't think it's the fact that people... It depends what sort of... It's weird, because it's kind of like what sort of people actually... Just because you can do a live gig... doesn't mean that people are going to want to even come to it. And so, yeah. Do you know what I mean? So, because people are scared, you know? And so it's kind of like, who are the people that are turning up anyway? And so it's, you don't even have sort of like a traditional or a regular kind of gauge on who that audience is.
Yeah, yeah.
So it might be people that are just desperate to leave the house, and there's an opportunity to do something that's not watching Netflix, or it might be the fact that they're diehard comedy fans and they're just desperate to see comedy. But I don't know. I don't know.
Go on. Well, I was just going to say, I remember, so when I was 17 and I just finished A-levels, we took the Changeling to the Edinburgh Festival, and we were a big
Changeling?
Cast.
Yeah, I was in the Changeling once.
Were you?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
I can't remember the characters' names. Did you play the bad guy?
I was the boring romantic one that has like a sex dungeon.
Yeah. Okay, I can't remember the names, except I played Beatrice Joanna. That's the only name I remember.
Right.
They'll come flooding back to me after this. Anyway, we were like a really big cast, totally disorganised, all kind of doing each other's costumes, all coming on in the wrong costume for each scene, always giggles all the time, you know, but loved it and it was our first, you know, in huge inverted commas for radio, professional gig. We had this brilliant sort of acting coach / director with us who a couple of times we had one person or two people in the audience, literally. That's it. And that's not that unusual for Edinburgh. It's not like we were kind of the show that everybody was clamouring to see. She said, just think that the person out there, this might be the one time they've gone out this week. They might have spent their £8 entrance fee or whatever it is on... This is hope for them. They are sitting down, not hoping to have a shitty couple of hours. You know, because as soon as there are fewer audience than there are performers, you have the right not to do it. So really, these will all get discussions of like, oh, shall we bother? And it was like, if you want to completely disrespect his efforts, then by all means, don't bother. And it sort of stayed with me anyway, as a kind of not worrying about audience sizes. And that sounds like I'm giving you advice. It really wasn't
advice. I think sometimes there are audiences at small gigs that when they realise it's a small gig, certainly in comedy, I think theatre's probably slightly different, actually, they would prefer to go home.
Right.
There is that.
Person that comedians are desperate for them to... Almost, you can look them in the eye and go, please laugh at this, and it puts an enormous amount of pressure on the audience member to go, I'm enjoying it, I'm having fun.
But I was the sole audience member for comedian Mike Bubbins' show at the McCuntlith Comedy Festival. And I was the only guy in there. It was me and there was Claire, who basically worked on the production of the show. So she'd seen it 50 times. And I was the only genuine audience member. And then maybe there was a technician. And it was one of the best things I've seen, because Mike just came out and did it like it was Las Vegas, and you go, oh, it's great. He didn't even acknowledge the fact there was only one person in the room. And some of my best gigs have been with, like, in Edinburgh, when me and Nat both started out in Edinburgh. And I think that that's such a great sort of, like, training ground for... I mean, it's It's becoming more elitist now, but I think when I did my first Edinburgh in 1997, and I think it was, we got taken up by the school. We did Romeo and Juliet. I've done shows where there's kind of like been like a handful of people in the audience, and they're always fun because you can kind of come off the rails a little bit and just sort of like tailor it more for the people in the room. But that's a comedy thing rather than, there's no point in bringing you on to talk to you about my experiences.
No one's less funny than me. No one's less funny than me, really.
I'm sure that's not true. But speaking of that topic, bad comedy. So you've been in Shakespeare. You were also in Juice Bigelow, European Gigolo, correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
Are we really speaking of comedy? I'm not sure that.
I mean, do you know what? The first film has kind of like not a large place in my heart, but I did quite enjoy the first one when it came out. The second one I did find quite horrifying. What was it like? Talk about it if you want to talk about it. You don't have to.
I'd seen the first one. I mean, not until I was offered the second one. I was offered the second one, and then I saw the first one. And I thought, oh, that's quite, you know, fun and funny. And actually, I think a lot of actually what happened probably just wouldn't happen now. This conversation is the first time I'm realizing that probably the Me Too Time's Up has already had a huge effect.
Mm-hmm.
I can feel just the sort of the idea of being somewhere to be jiggly bosoms and keep your mouth shut is not. Maybe it would happen again. Maybe I'm too old for people to want it to happen again. But I think there was a feeling on that of. So I've filmed some incredibly intense, serious stuff, and it's been the biggest laugh, and everybody's had to kind of, you know, stop themselves from misbehaving.
Sure.
And then some things that would be perceived as being kind of farce or comedy, which have been just incredibly hard work and no fun at all. I don't want to kind of name names I was very unhappy with the powerlessness I felt about, as an actor, you know, you want to work and you're told from the minute that you decide to act, everybody tells you it's never going to happen. You'll never get any work. You need to train in something else. You need to have a backup plan. So the actors, comedians who carry on, you haven't probably got, maybe you're both trained barristers, I don't know, but I imagine there's not much of a backup plan. Certainly I don't have a backup plan. So you've kind of taken that plunge and then you get a job and you get jobs and it just seems too good to be true. But you are always have that feeling. I always, certainly in my 20s, as I was when I filmed that, had the feeling of, well, I should just be grateful and shut up. Because mm-hmm. there are a million other girls who look like me who they could have instead, and they've chosen me for whatever reason. And actually looking back on it, one of the reasons that they probably chose me is because I looked like somebody that would shut up. And I don't think that's a great attribute to have now.
As in you look like that you could just stand there like a human prop and...
Well, you know, smile and sort of do, you know, I don't even want to talk about the specifics of the film because it's sort of, you know, as soon as I start sounding bitter, maybe it's too late for that.
But, I've done an hour of that before you came on.
I guess we're all meant to feel very grateful for things and very... Yes. And that's the culture of it, is any kind of work you get, you're supposed to be like, well, I'm the lucky one. Whereas actually, there are some things that you're allowed to say that's unacceptable about. And that's more what I guess you need to...
And the feeling of this feels horrible. This feels really horrible. This feels I'm not feeling pride or like I'm feeling that kind of awful feeling of shame that you feel when you're little and something's going down that you're not really happy with, or do you know what I mean? That I don't know, you've witnessed somebody being bullied, that kind of thing, and you carry that little shame with you. That was my experience of kind of, well, I should deny my feelings. I think that's even the stage before denying yourself the right to speak up. Is like, I shouldn't be feeling this. I should just be feeling lucky. Shut your brain down.
Mm.
You know? Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, but I know someone that's been on a production recently, and not that there was some problematic things that were happening during the production, and I think that what the Me Too movement has sort of done is it's enabled people to speak up about it while it's happening, as opposed to, you know, well, they're having a bad time, but if I keep my eyes down and I don't cause a problem, I won't get fired. It kind of like actually gives people the power to sort of like be able to speak out about things that are going wrong as they're happening, and yes, to be able to say, actually, I think that that could be perceived as racist or sexist or misogynistic or whatever.
Right, right.
And I think that actually it gives, obviously it's like an empowering movement, but I think that I don't necessarily know how much people are very unself-aware. So I don't know how much it's going to like immediately affect the way people behave and treat people, but I think. Yeah. It gives people the power to actually speak up when that stuff happens.
And also maybe, as you said, to defend. So, for example, last thing I'll say on that film that I'm not at all bitter about, there was something, a scene that another actress and I refused to do. It was something that wasn't scripted. And they suddenly said, hey, you know, let's try this. That'll be funny. And we were like, I don't think it would be funny. And we called our agents and they said, you don't have to do it. They shot it anyway with doubles. They shot it anyway without us. So it looks just as if we did it. It's a tiny moment, but it's a moment that neither me or the other actress did, but partook in. We were both in a different country at the time to them filming it. So, and you go, oh my God, that they did it. They actually, that, and I actually didn't see the film for years after. And then nobody had said anything. I mean, I hadn't, it never even occurred to me that it would be in there anyway. And I don't know, I think now there'd be more, you know, I'm losing my thread really, except that I think, you know, there'd be a stronger leg to stand on now with saying, sure, you know, this is not something we agreed to, do not do it, as opposed to maybe in the old days where somebody would say, listen, you've been paid, just let it go.
Of course, but I've been in similar situations where I was in a thing and what I'd signed on for was something different, and then when we got all the scripts through, there were just loads and loads of fat jokes in it, at my expense. And I was just like, oh, I wouldn't have signed on for this because that's not how I depict myself. And, you know, I would have turned this down had that been on the table. And so we had to go through the thing where I talked to my agent and, I asked them to remove them because I had a bit of power and they refused. And so I had to go through my agent. And then when the sides turned up on the day that we had to do the stuff, all of the jokes were still in there. And I had a moment in my dressing room where I was just like, do I go against how I feel? I was like frozen because I was in my dressing room and I had to get into the costume and film the scene where they were just going to make fun of my weight. And I was just like, I don't want to leave my dressing room, but I know I'm holding up production. So should I just grin and bear it and go out and just do the stuff that I'm absolutely against, that I said right from day one that I was against it? And then what happened was the producer came in and they printed out the wrong sides and they said, oh, have you looked at your sides yet? And I was like, no. And they said, oh, these are the sides for the day. And I looked and it wasn't in there. But all they'd done was remove the line. So where I originally had a line, they didn't invent a new line. They just took my line out of it. And so then it was like, okay, well, that's sort of like the laziest way you could have handled that.
Yeah, exactly.
He's actually given me, you know, I'll do the fat joke if it means that I get more screen time. Do you know what I mean? But it was like one of those things where you feel pressured because there's a whole machine that's in operation and you're delaying it. And the pressure when you're immediately on set is, if I just do it, then everyone can get on with their day. But then it's on film forever. And then it's kind of like, and you know, it's good.
I mean, I'm very sorry you both had really horrible experiences. That sounds horrific. But I guess that's it as well, because you must have that pressure as well of feeling like you don't want to be perceived as being difficult. I guess that's another side to it as well, or have a reputation for being awkward or difficult to work with, when actually you shouldn't be put in that position in the first place. And I guess
Go on. No, well, I just think fuck them, because you've created the problem, and now I have to deal with it, and you're making me look like the arsehole for having to speak up. But you've created that problem.
That's it. Yeah, and I think as well, if you don't engage in conflict, sometimes I think there are ways of doing these things, which probably I'm getting better at, where there is no evidence of physically holding anything up by wanting your say, or, you know, you can be gracious in your, sorry, I'm so sorry, that's not going to happen. But, you know, I'm fine, I'm here, I'm going to have a cup of tea. You know what I mean? It's somehow there's a difference between being true to yourself and feeling the need to have conflict.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think as well it's that kind of sort of showbiz world of acting and stand-up and things. It's often a place where you don't really have, like, a PR bit of the company that you can go to and say, oh, I don't like this, or I don't, this is a problem, or I have an issue with this person or something that was said, because I think it's traditionally been something that's almost part of the circus. It's that sort of everyone's a bit more freewheeling, whereas actually there's lots of stuff that can go down that I guess could be used as an excuse as well. Whereas actually, you know, it's very important that everyone kind of feels comfortable to be there. Otherwise, and it's good that you've got your agents you can go to, that they are backing you up as well, because just that world is almost seen as a bit more freewheeling, and it's not, people enjoy that world because it doesn't feel as kind of corporate an entity as working in an office. But in that surrounding, you do have some protection, which you don't really have in a kind of showbiz environment.
Yeah.
But there's also the social level where you think, if you're in the middle of a production, you're thinking, I don't want to make the rest of the production awkward.
You know? Yeah.
Because I've got to work with them for another 3 months. Or whatever.
But don't you think the crew know who's nice? Mm. You know, the crew generally know. The crew, it's generally, I think, you don't have, like, whoever it might be that's kind of working on the floor, there's always that ease there. And that if somebody is a little bit tricky, there is a dis-ease there, even if they're lovely to them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get it. But then also, it doesn't have to be the entire crew. It has to be, if it's just that one person that you see every day that actually makes the rest of the job an absolute chore.
Yes.
Then it's kind of like...
Have you had that? Have you had somebody that has ruined a job for you?
There's always,
or a relationship that's ruined a job for you?
I think there's all... It could be on any part of production, right? It might be another performer, or it might be... someone behind the scenes or behind the camera, but I think there's always a cunt on every production. There's always one. And it's always me. I just think there's always someone on one production that you kind of like, why do you have to be like that? Because everyone else has really kind of like gone into the spirit of things. I don't know. Anyway.
And then the last thing I'll say on that, don't you find then that a really older, wiser cast member always just says about that person, darling, they're just insecure. And it always comes down to that. Always.
I think it is. I think it is. And also, for a lot of my worst experiences that have been created by individuals, you look back on it and you go, you can kind of sort of like, you might not realise it at the time while it's happening, because you're kind of like, when you're on set, you've got a microphone on and you feel like you're in a Cold War submarine where you're trying to communicate with your makeup artist through eye gestures going, this is insane. But everyone's, I'm bugged. Everyone can hear what I'm thinking at all times. And so it's kind of like you have the, but when you're out of the situation, you can kind of rationalise it and you can kind of go, they were having a terrible time, they were being shat on from above and they were just, you know. So I don't know. But that's, I don't know, that's sort of, this is gone.
Oh God, this took
a left turn.
Is this not your normal?
No, but it's good. I think it's really good. tell us about Trading Places. So we never go. You've got this huge career that, but we never ever talk to our guests about what they are fans of, and we always try every week, and it never comes to light, and even if we try, we get derailed. So let's go through. What are your favourite films?
So I would say the film that I have watched more than any other is Trading Places.
Right.
The film that I watch when I'm on my own and just want to feel lovely is Adam's Rib.
So who's in Adam's Rib? Spencer Tracy.
Catherine Hepburn. Yeah, yeah. It's Catherine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, and you just have to see it. And Judy Holliday is, she won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar for it, I think. The way they riff off each other, Catherine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy, they're so easy with each other. I don't know how many films they'd already made together by the time they did Adam's Rib, but they just, everything about it is easy. And it was made in the 1940s, possibly 1950. I don't know. Anyway, late 40s, early 50s. But, it could be any time. It's just completely, it's a joy. It's total joy. Sorry?
Food, is it that kind of?
Well, it's more. There's a lot of energy in it. You know, it's a sparring. They're sparring partners as well as lovers. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of, and also it's not quite switch off. You can't sort of just go and or have another conversation or send a text when you're watching it, because all the little nuances, you don't want to miss anything. You know,
That's the sort of thing that if that was on at the BFI, I would go and see that.
Amazing. I've never seen it on the big screen. I would be there in a heartbeat.
What did I say? I saw Bringing Up Baby last year. And it's great because if I watched that at home, I would be on my phone and fucking around. And when you actually get to sit in a lovely cinema like Screen One at the BFI, yeah, and you are forced to sort of like pay attention for 2 hours, it's like the best experience. And then your third favourite film is...
There are a lot of potential thirds, but When Harry Met Sally, I think would be probably the film I've also watched the most. And then there'd be Flashdance. Nothing wildly highbrow. Flashdance was a total favourite.
When I saw Flashdance, I saw it quite late, and when I saw it, I was like, oh, this must be what men feel like when they watch Top Gun. I was just I loved it so much. I love Flashdance so much.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's great. But when Harry Met Sally is one of the... I don't know, because a lot of people don't like Sleepless in Seattle, but I think Sleepless in Seattle is probably like the last classic Hollywood romantic comedy. But I think When Harry Met Sally was like maybe the penultimate... end of an era.
It's beautiful. Sleepless in Seattle is beautiful, but, you know, they really don't get any scenes together, which, of course, is kind of the point. When Harry Met Sally, between them, Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan, they're so mismatched. They're so, you know, she's like a foot taller than he is. I'm obsessed with everything about Meg Ryan in that film. And the way they are together is just so funny. It's like no dialogue you've heard before. Mm. And Rob Reiner's direction, everything's just amazing.
Well, I'm of the opinion that Rob Reiner is the greatest director of the 1980s. I think he's better than Spielberg. Like, he did every genre. He did, you know, I go on about it all the time, but he did Spinal Tap, Stand By Me. He did When Harry Met Sally, Princess Bride. He did, what's that John Cusack film? The Sure Thing. He did Misery, A Few Good Men.
Like, and then did he do Misery?
He did Misery.
Did he?
Yeah, his production company is Castle Rock, which is named after when he did Stand By Me, which is another Stephen King adaptation. He set up a production company, Castle Rock, which is where Stephen King bases most of his stuff. And so then every time you see Castle Rock, that's a Rob Reiner film. Like, he did so many films all the way up to North. They're all five-star classics, and they're all completely different genres. They might be comedies, but like he like invented the mockumentary. And
it's Did you say Princess Bride?
Yeah, Princess Bride. Like he made, they were just, they were all bangers, like one after another.
Yeah.
Like, what a run. He did like seven or eight films.
Did he do all the Christopher Guest ones? He did Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show. No.
He did Spinal Tap, and then Christopher Guest did all of the Christopher Guest ones.
Okay. That makes sense.
But it's so good. Oh, we're running out of time. What's your favourite bit in Trading Places?
Oh, my God. Favourite bit. Oh, $1. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
It's the two old men in the bathroom. They're two old men, and then it's actually Dan Aykroyd who says $1 like that. But there's the moment in the bathroom when they have that amazing conversation where the old man says what's that actor's name? Ralph Bellamy. And he says, you know, they're very musical people, aren't they? And all that kind of thing. And they just have this awful conversation. And, I've forgotten that. Anyway, please don't.
Ralph Bellamy is also in a screwball comedy way, is in His Girl Friday. And when they ask, what does he look like? They say, he kind of looks a bit like Ralph Bellamy. I like that. It's
just that's good.
Like a little extra bit of joke.
my favourite bit in Trading Places is the bit when they explain to Eddie Murphy what pork bellies are, and then he looks directly down the camera and then it's such a good film.
He says, or bacon, like you might have a bacon, lettuce and tomato sandwich.
And then he looks directly down the camera like, what the fuck? And then he's so good. Right, so we're almost at the end. We've got to play a game with you now. I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel and he will take it away.
Hey, Miranda, this is a game called Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinion. The score point.
On your opinion?
On my opinion.
Okay. Yeah.
Beginning with Prince. But is Freddie Mercury better or worse than Prince, based on
worse.
Oh, wow, that was a tough one. That was a really tough one.
Paul McCartney, better or worse than Freddie Mercury?
Worse.
Worse.
Paul McCartney is better.
Wow, this is a tough one.
David Bowie, better or worse than Paul McCartney?
Better.
Better. John Lennon, better or worse than David Bowie?
Worse.
Worse.
Worse. Mick Jagger, better or worse than John Lennon?
Worse.
Worse. Ringo Starr, better or worse than Mick Jagger?
Better.
Yellow Submarine, not sure. Worse.
Better.
Oh, wow.
George Harrison, better or worse than Ringo Starr?
Better,
I'm going to say.
Better. Elton John, better or worse than George Harrison?
Worse.
Elvis Presley, better or worse than Elton John?
Better.
Elvis Costello, better or worse than Elvis Presley?
Worse.
By the downward intonation, I'm going to say worse.
Worse. Well intonated.
You got a great. What eight. Was that? You got eight. Well, okay. So you scored an eight, which means that you're not quite as good with Jen Brister, Thomas Coombs, Jason Manford, Joe Scaldini, with 10, Ken Cheng, Harry Hill, Luke Morley with 9. But you are as good as Susie Dent, Charles Eston, David Hepworth, Magical Bone, Samantha Morton, Matt Okine, Chris Stark, Stu Whiffen with 8, and you're better than James King, Henry Normal, Johnny Vegas with 7, and Gary Delaney with 6. So you've absolutely smashed that.
Samantha Morton, I'll take Samantha Morton. She's one of my favourites.
That was a really great chat. Thanks for coming
on.
We've been talking to Miranda Raisin, who's now a member of the Clubhouse. We haven't worked out. We've not worked out how to wrap up. We're working on how to wrap up.
Okay.
And you're in Warrior Season 2, which is on Sky One on Wednesdays at 10. Don't go anywhere. But for everyone listening at home, thank you very much for listening today. I hope you're all keeping well and safe. And me and Nat will talk to you again next week. Thank you for listening. Bye.